coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation. It's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome to Hagman. It's the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. We refuse to be silenced. We're not going to be silenced. Otherwise, well, temporarily inconvenienced. We apologize for the lack of yesterday's show. Remember, we had a situation with some water in the studio and electronics and such. Well, we thought we had that repaired until yesterday. Well, the day before yesterday, the night before yesterday, when we realized that not quite, that's an understatement. Yeah. So we had to bring construction workers back out, and they got here and they cut our internet and, buried internet cables. So it took a while for them to get us back up, but by the time we were back up, it was too late to do the show, and you know how that goes. So we're back today, and we're back with a vengeance, I'll say that. So I want to thank you for your patience. People are saying, what happened to you guys? Thanks for worrying about us, and thank you very much for your inquiries. Of course, we're fine. We're fine at all. Or we're fine completely. Did you happen to see the Democratic debate yesterday? Oh, my goodness. You talk about a circus. You just watch that, and I believe you'll understand the direction our country is headed and would be headed sans Donald Trump. I'll just say that. And I don't care what you think about Donald Trump. It doesn't matter. It's now this ideological divide, the socialist versus everyone else. Much like, as I said before with Islam, it's Islam versus every other religion. It's the socialist versus everyone else. They're actually not even socialist. It's pure communism pushing toward that one world globalistic order. And that's the way it is. All right. Simply put. I just got the feeling, I don't know about you guys, but I got the feeling in reviewing the video from the debates, I got the feeling like I was in sixth grade history class or something, or a sixth grade class of some kind. In Klobuchar, what was that about? Is she tearing up, crying, shaking, vibrating? I don't know. And
that's who you want for president.
Yeah, really. And Pete, just a tip, Buttigieg. where'd that come from? Anyway, and Creepy Joe and Sleepy Joe, Bloomberg.
Sleepy Bloomberg.
Oh my gosh, Bloomberg. Seriously? You think I'm bad. Okay. I get emails saying, well, you can't, it takes you 20 minutes to spin in there and you're really. Okay. I'm not running for president. I know my limitations. Wow, man. So there was some bloodletting yesterday in Vegas. All right. I just want to let you guys know that, yeah, we're following that. And I want to get some, information out to you, give you my analysis, not just the debates, but in the bigger picture. And that's what's really, in my view, that's what this is all about. It's about the bigger picture, isn't it? It's about the picture of where this country is headed. And today I've got a great show, and I'm going to get to it here momentarily, because Steve Quayle from stevequayle.com, you know, folks, we're having a conference, or Steve, I should say, Steve is having a conference in July. It's not we as in me too, although I will be there, and I believe in this conference. So what Steve's trying to do and what we're trying to do is give you the people who are going to be there, what they're going to be talking about, but even more importantly, the information behind that. So I want to get to that right away. But before I do, look, folks, it's time your furniture matched your fearless style. Really, your furniture should suit your needs, but also it should feel uniquely you. That's where Joybird comes in. I love my Joybird couch. It's in my office. And let me tell you something. It's a reflection of my personality. I customized it. I thought of it. I mean, and they built it and they delivered it to me. It's endless customizable options. That means the days of settling for things, they're over. go on Joybird's Instagram. The Joybird's Instagram gives you a daily dose of what's trending in customers' homes, whether it's mid-century, modern, or whatever. Weekly blog for tips and tricks. Now, here's the deal. With Joybird, your personal one-of-a-kind style should match your furniture. Joybird offers a range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery options so your creations can stand the test of time and wrath of your furry friends and toddlers. And their protection plan, well, they help keep prices, or the furniture pieces, looking as great as the day they came into your home. And you can ask me, between Lady the Studio Dog, Theo, her stepbrother, that cute little Karen Terrier, oh, my goodness, and the police with the battle rattle on, right? Well, they gave my couch a workout for the last 6 months. The latter, of course, the police I'm talking about, and of course the dogs all the time. But it stands the test of time. Hey, relax now, pay later with our financing options. Your rates could be low as 0% APR for 18 months. The furniture's handcrafted. The 365-day home trial. You can skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. Folks, here is all you need to know. Go to joybird.com/Hagman, but listen carefully. You create furniture that matches your own fearless style. You create what you want and they'll build it for you. It's fantastic. Go to joybird.com/Hagman. That's joybird.com/Hagman. See how Joybird can help make your dream space a reality today at joybird.com/Hagman. Go to joybird.com/Hagman. Remember, there's two N's on Hagman, and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code Hagman. Love this company. What a great company. Joybird.com/Hagman. All right. Now, Steve Quayle, a good friend, stevequayle.com. You know, Branson, Missouri, the conferences that Steve's had over the last couple of years, man, have they been great. I'm going to just turn the program over to Steve right now. I want Steve to introduce Gary Wayne and give you folks a taste of what's coming in many respects. So with that, let's give it up for Steve Quayle. Steve, how are you?
Hey, good, Doug. And thanks for having me on with Gary Wayne. And Gary Wayne's is going to be one of the keynote speakers, and he's the author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. And what I appreciate about Gary is his systematic approach to the Word of God. Now, it's funny, Doug, because he calls himself a Christian contrarian who's maintained a lifelong love affair with Bible prophecy. The minute you say Genesis 6 Giants, you just about have released the skeptics and doubters amongst biblical Christians into the stratosphere. 90% of Christianity doesn't understand the relevance, nor do they understand the days of Noah statement that Jesus spoke about that would precede his second coming. And the True Legends Conference this year, and I thank Gary, and I'm going to bring him on right away, is called Ancient Cataclysms and the Coming Catastrophes, the Pre-Adamic Era, and the Return of the Days of Noah. It's July 10th through 12th in Branson, Missouri. And ladies and gentlemen, this is a busy time, so please go on gen6.com and pick up your reservations. We have room discounts available. But again, this is in the middle of summer, and it's important, Doug. We usually had it in September. But come September, October, just as I made the statement on the last Branson conference, that things would never be the same again after that conference. We all know things changed dramatically, and now we're in the 10 plagues, and we're in the time of unparalleled evil happening. But Gary Wayne wrote a book that's really, I would say this, astonishingly relevant, and he understands. So, you know, he's on talk shows all over the place. So, Gary, I want to bring you on, and the subject I want to talk about is the absolute necessity of understanding. We'll go, you know, we'll jump around a lot, brother, but, you know, the absolute necessity of understanding how, you know, history has been affected both before and immediately after the flood, and how it's going to relate to the coming future prophetic events that we're now seeing play out. So go ahead and lay it out as you would like to lay it out. And when you get tired or need a breath, give it back to me. But people want to hear from you, and thank you coming and being a keynote speaker at Branson this year.
Well, thank you for inviting me to the show and to this audience and to be with Doug and yourself and to speak at the Branson Convention in July. So excited to be here. And I think the point that you raise in terms of prehistory, why is it important? And for me, if you don't understand what is going on in prehistory, you're not going to be able to get a full understanding and a complete understanding, but an accurate understanding as well as to what has transpired after the flood, our history, what is going on today, and how the end time is going to come about, and the deceptions that are going to be built in to deceive you are going to be so great that you're going to be part of that elect that can be deceived if that were possible. And of course, Jesus has warned us that it is. So for me, to understand prophecy and history, you have to understand prehistory because everything rolls forward from that. It's the sort of old Adam that nothing is new under the sun, and we're seeing sort of this thing repeat over and over and over, but it has a genesis, so to speak. And we have to understand what prehistory is. And so I have to remind people surprisingly a lot that there is prehistory that's after the flood, where we don't have a written record, so that's part of prehistory. But then you also have a prehistory that happens before the flood where we have very little records as well. And then there's this big question, was what was before that, if anything? And that would also be classified as prehistory, no matter what your views are on was there something before Eden, was there something before Genesis 1:1-2. So when we talk about prehistory, these are the events that happened before, a lot of the events happened before humankind are even created. And we need to understand what happens in prehistory to understand why humans are created. So this obviously goes back to, the angelic rebellion, and everything sort of rolls forward from that angelic rebellion and why angels and fallen angels in this case take it as a personal vendetta, so to speak, as an oath that they have taken to destroy humankind. And that's all important in understanding what is going on in prehistory and in history and what is going on now, because this is the organizational structure that gets set up.
And if I can interject something here, Steve and Gary, I undoubtedly, I'm going to see comment after comment and get email after email of people saying, it doesn't matter, or them disagreeing with your premise the issue here is, I think at the core is why is there such animosity or such animus between different belief systems? And if it doesn't matter, just tell me it doesn't matter, frankly, because it doesn't matter to me. But why is there such animus?
And I'll let Gary answer this really quick, but it does matter because again, people have no idea where conflict originates. Obviously, everything that is in the book of Revelation, all the prophets speak about the time period that's going to appear before Messiah or take place before Messiah. This is critical. It's like saying, where does good and evil come from? That's what Gary's going to talk about right now. And again, the pre-Adamic era, Genesis 1:1-2, and if you don't mind, Gary, I just want to lay this out real simply for everybody. Fallen angels rebelled against God. They are in total warfare against him. The enmity that God has placed between us and the devil and his followers is an eternal warfare. So, I think the bottom line is let's just explain, Gary, you explain to people why Genesis 6:1-4 is so important, because Doug will get what I call the nanny goats, They won't believe anything yet. The history of Genesis has been covered up, the prehistory and the pre-Adamic era, and the early church, all the early fathers believed in it. Peter talks about, the times that were. So the thing that I think it's really important, let's lay it out right now, and I want you to go into your full fury mode. And I'm not saying you're angry, but you're full force mode, Gary, and tell people why it is so critical. Because again, unless they understand the origin of conflict, they cannot understand the fruit of conflict that they're now seeing with their very eyes. And your statement that devil and his angels are making war on the saints, they have taken an oath. So take it from there, if you will, because brother, this is called confrontation radio. You know, we have to be able to present the truth, present it in a biblical basis, a historical basis, a mythological basis, and a reality contemporary event basis, and it all ties together. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, yeah, and as important as the first five verses or first five chapters of Genesis are, Genesis 6 is a nexus point in the days of Noah that is going to change everything thereafter in terms of how the permanent sort of organizational structure and mystical religions are also going to be set against the descendants of Adam. So when the angels take this oath to create the Nephilim, the giants as they're recorded in the King James Bible, and that goes back to the word Nephil, and I am is the male plural, the Nephilim giants. These are the demigods that are going to usurp the kingships of the antediluvian world and will partner with the mystical religion, which is the sun-worshipping religion, which goes back a little bit further with the descendants of Cain and Enoch, son of Cain. And people need to understand there are two Enochs, and people tend to overlook that fact. There's Enoch, son of Cain, and there's Enoch, son of Jared. And we can't get those two conflated because that's what the polytheist forces do. So this oath that is taken to what I would call probably the third revenge of Satan and the rebellious angels is to create this demigod race that is going to usurp the kingships and impose the mystical religion. There is only basically two belief systems in the world when you boil it down. One is the one that is set up by, first of all, Enoch, son of Cain, who creates the sun-worshipping bull cult of the antediluvian epoch in a rebellious sort of nature that is passed on to him from Cain, but to honor the pantheon of gods that have rebelled against God, the fallen angels, and this religion is set up to worship them. And so when we look at all the different pantheons that are set up around the world in the ancient epoch, they're essentially the same pantheon. They just have different vernacular names and different sort of local rituals and sacrifices, but all honoring the same pantheon of gods that will have Satan at the apex. And so this is the organizational structure that is set up in the end time that is the religion that will also cross the flood, as well as giants showing up after the flood. And we get all of this as an understanding about prehistory that is not taught in church. And why that is so important is that this religion and their sponsors, both the angels and the demons, are aligned against the descendants of Adam, Israel, Christians, from the beginning of time, because they don't want humankind to be raised above angels in the future time, as we're adopted through the resurrection, by Jesus as sons of God, even though we have human fathers. And so that's a future promise that they're trying to prevent, and they're also trying to justify their rebellion. But, of course, we know in 1 Peter when Jesus, and I think he goes to the abyss to talk to these evil, impassioned angels who created the Nephilim, he's basically telling them that once I rise on Sunday, then your fate is sealed. You're going to be going to the lake of fire. And I think that this is very clear that the angels, even though they thought they probably couldn't defeat God, that they were trying to create another realm, did not anticipate their crucifixion. And, of course, that's talked about in the book of Corinthians. Otherwise, they wouldn't have crucified Jesus. And so this is the religion and the organizational structure that is always opposed to Israel and to Christianity. And it is a sponsor. It is a route to those religions. And we need to understand that we are their enemies. We may not look at them as our enemies, but they look at us as their enemy. And Israel and Christians have always been the stumbling block to setting up the New World Order. That's been tried to be set up over and over and over and over. So when we get these angels, and a lot of people, as you know, as mentioned, don't think that the sons of God are angels. You know, there's an incredible amount of scripture that would support that they are indeed angels. And if somebody wants to get a hold of me after the show through my website, I'll send you a couple detailed documents that will walk you through step by step, verse by verse, as to why we know that these are angels. But this is that organizational structure that comes out of prehistory and gets reestablished after the flood, affects all of our history. And when we look at Genesis 6, 1 through 4, we see the sons of God and the Nephilim. And in the end time, we get these mighty men. We get these angels that are coming out of the abyss. We get the angels that are sent down in the war in heaven in Revelation 12. We probably have other angels that are already there that didn't go to the abyss, that weren't the impassioned ones, that are also involved in the end time. And we're also told about these demons that are coming out of the mouth of the false prophet and the Antichrist. So we have all of these connections that connect into the end time. And then we have things that are very, very interesting that were taught about in the New Testament, that we don't fight just against flesh and blood, but we fight against the spirit of wickedness and the evil rulers that, you know, that are ruling this world. And we're taught that, you know, these are also known as the invisible ones. And all of these terms that we're talking about are drafted by these polytheist religions and are part of their organizational structure and belief system, because they have a complete counterfeit religion that is designed to destroy Christianity and the Holy Covenant first begat with Israel from the face of the earth. So that's kind of a quick swath through the whole sort of concept, but we need to understand that Lucifer's, or Satan as I prefer to call him as opposed to Lucifer, Satan's first revenge against humankind begins in Eden, with working with the Nakash to deceive Adam and Eve. And after that, you have all of these other revenges that are coming in short order, with Genesis 6 being probably the most significant event after the fall.
Let me have you deal with one thing, okay? We better touch on the sons of God. And it's important, because the thing that the number one, I've been at this for 40 some years, and please, that just makes me an old guy, but you know, I'd say pretty well researched. But the two criticisms are where Jesus said, in heaven, they are neither given or taken in marriage, but are as the angels. But people can't separate that scripture from the angels which are in heaven to the angels that would basically come to earth in rebellion against God. And only 200 originally fell before the flood of Noah and had the sex. Obviously, the book of Enoch and some of the other extra-biblical texts talk about that. But a third of the angels, and the Bible says they're innumerable. So I want you to take the time, because this is critical. This is a foundational point where the sons of God. I want you to share that. We've got 2 hours, and that is critical to understanding, because, you know, they basically will make every excuse in the sons of Seth theory, forgive me, and people got to understand that the devil themselves have hidden themselves until the appointed time of the revealing. So please deal with the sons of God on the show now, because it's a foundational principle of what we're going to be both at Branson, but continuing on with your interview.
Yeah, it's such a good point, and it is one of those sort of crossroad threshold points that sort of separates and either helps you understand things more or conceals things more, depending on how you want to deal with who the sons of God are. And again, for the listeners out there, if they want to get a hold of me, I also have another document that walks through it step by step why the sons of God can't be the Sethites or what is understood as the sons of God in the New Testament. And again, it's about putting all of the passages together so that you can get a full understanding, not just the convenient ones. I won't be able to go through all of them because there's a significant amount, but I'll give you a good flavor for how we know the sons of God are actually angels. And so the first verses, which are really quite easy to sort of assemble, come up in the book of Job. So Job 1:6, Job 2:1, Job 34 verses 4 through 7 talks about the sons of God who are presenting themselves. And actually Satan in verses chapters 1 and 2 will actually follow the sons of God into heaven. And a lot of people say, well, that still doesn't mean that those are angels. It's just, you know, God could have had a throne set up in Eden, except that after Eden, we don't have the sons of God, you know, going into heaven because that's where the throne of heaven is located. So when you get beyond the King James Version translation, a lot of the other English translations will also use the word angels. And, you know, you take that back to Hebrew, it's Ben Ha'Elohim, and that's the, you know, the sons of God. And so when we get into Job 34:7, we're now linked with the sons of God at creation along with the morning stars. And again, stars is another significant understanding because these are almost like two orders that they're talking about. The morning stars and the sons of God who, you know, are praising God when creation is made in the beginning. And so we know that humans aren't around at the point of creation. They first show up in day six. So there's no way they can be talking, you know, Job can be talking about humans in that verse. Now, when we move into some other verses, we're going to do a little bit of cross-referencing here, but I like Psalms 82 as sort of the next one where you have the sons of the Most High and the council of the gods. And again, this is not talking about humans. This is talking about the rebellious angels that are ruling the earth, both before the flood and after the flood. And it's got a lot of relationship to Deuteronomy 28 with the 70 nations and the 70 offspring of Noah, and as the same number as the sons that were born to Jacob in Israel. But you have this ruling council of gods, whether or not they're replaced after the flood with some of the ones that went to the abyss or not, which is probably likely because we do know the angels went to the abyss for their impassioned crimes. But you have this council of gods that is being referred to, and they're not humans. Even though they're going to die like humans, this is a verse, when you take that back to Hebrew, you go back to that word, you know, sons of the Most High, going back to angels. And getting a little bit of feedback right now. But as we talk, to cross-link this with other passages, you have the host of heaven, which is the army of heaven, and you also have the term stars. And all of these verses support each other. So they're used in combination throughout the Old Testament, that they will be positioned together so that you know they are a part of the host. The host has several different ranks and orders, whether or not it is the seraphim or the cherubim or the ophanim, which I think are what a lot of the church fathers would talk about as the thrones, whether or not they're the powers that they're talked about, which comes from exousia, whether or not they are the principalities, arca, whether or not they are the, archangels. You have a significant amount of, of angels. I'm going to have to mute for a second.
Yeah, go ahead and take a breath there. We're talking with Steve Quayle from stevequayle.com. Of course, all the links are going to be in the program description box at hagmanreport.com. And Gary Wayne, again, his website Genesis 6 conspiracy in the program. Links to that will be in the program description box as well. Glad to have them both on and giving you a little taste of what's coming at the True Legends or for the True Legends conference in Branson. So, with that, again, I'm very, very happy to have them back. And I'm going to apologize, of course, to our listening audience for the lack of program yesterday. Again, our internet lines were inadvertently cut and, hate when that happens, right? So anyway, how you doing, Gary? You okay now? Hey, go ahead, Steve. Steve, go ahead.
I think there's something going on here, and I rebuke the powers of darkness in Jesus' name. The deal is that what we're going to do, and, you know, with the various speakers, and this is the first time Gary Wayne has ever been on with me and on with you at the same time, but we're trying to give to everybody from the beginning of time, the time, the reason pre-Adamic is avoided by Christianity, because they say the earth is 6,000 years old. The recreated earth is 6,000 years old. I believe Adam and Eve are only 6,000 years ago. But prior to that, there's an indeterminate amount of time in which the civilizations, the ancient civilization, the gods and the goddesses and the mythological times and beings and the architecture and the scientific advances and all of the interplay between heavenly beings and earthly beings. And then prior to the creation of earthly beings in Genesis, we're in the book of Genesis when God created mankind. Here's the deal. The Apostle Paul talks about the time when humans are going to judge angels. Angels believe that Jesus is the Son of God. They're doing everything they can to avoid their judgment. And the very people, forgive me, the very fallen angels that are making war on the saints, us, are going to be judged by us, by the redeemed. We can't do it in our contemporary minds. We can't do it in our contemporary understanding. But with by faithfulness to the Lord and the transformation that takes place when we do get our heavenly bodies and our heavenly minds and God reveals all things to us, then he lets us, in essence, get the upper hand. And there's Hebrew traditions and myths out there that state that when God created Adam and then obviously took Eve out of Adam, out of Adam's rib, that God commanded the angels to worship his, meaning God's handiwork, not Adam and Eve. And some people twist that. God said, look what I have just done, angels. You guys were created out of the fire. You are my messengers, but look what I've done. I'll speak for the Father and the Son. We have created Adam in our image and likeness. And that is where the fury, the jealousy, the rage, the murder, and everything is done. Because the Bible teaches specifically that there is a spiritual war. People quote Ephesians 6, and as I've said, we're trying to share with people the root of evil that is going to produce the fruit of evil. Ancient history is going to bring about present reality and the destruction on mankind and the advanced technology and the people that have yielded, the secret societies, the globalists, the elitists, their necessary appetite and desire for the blood of innocents. The cannibalism, which was the singular trait that permeated the world from the giants that fled all over the world, fled from the presence of the Lord. So, you know, this is really important. The sons of God, and I'm not trying to capitalize on Gary, but Gary, you've got a brother, you've got to be a little more forceful because I don't want to, we only got 2 hours and we've got to get the bottom line. And I hope you got your spat. Go ahead.
Yeah, my voice is back. Sorry about that. So when we pull these terms together, I really like the heavenly host that is used in partnership with all the different sort of categories of these angels. And as you were mentioning, Steve, it's a significant amount. And, you know, both Daniel and Revelation talks about, you know, 10,000 times 10,000 or 100 million. Whether or not there's more or that's completely literal or not, that would mean at least 33 million angels rebelled, at least will have rebelled by the time of Revelation 12. So this host of heaven, If you take that back, that has a word for Saba, which means an army of angels or a large body of angels, but generally in the sense of an army. And the other side has an army too, and it's very important to understand that. And heavenly is, or heaven comes from the Hebrew word shemayim, which is, means in the heavens and or, heavenly ones or lofty ones. As you take that back to its singular form of shema. The I am is the male plural again. So the heavenly host are the army of heaven, if you look that as a translation. And the ones who rebelled are the rebellious army and host of heaven that have decided to ensure that they are going to do everything that they could and can do to prevent humankind from reaching our destiny. And so if you misunderstand what is going on in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, you do not understand the organizational structure and the societal structure that has been set up ever since and then again crosses the flood, because you have these Rephaim giants that show up after the flood. They put in the same mystical religion. That's why the woman in Revelation rides the seven empires, why it's a religion and why how it controls the religions as part of that organizational structure. And it's the Rephaim giants, the post-diluvian giants that usurp the kingships after the flood. So when you see giant in the New Testament or in the Old Testament after the flood in the King James Version, that goes back to the Hebrew word Rapha, and I am Rephaim for the male plural, as opposed to the Nephilim. It only shows up three times, but the post-diluvian giants that somehow show up after the flood, and we're not told how, other than that they do show up. And in Genesis 6 through 1 through 4, we're told that the sons of God went to human females and then again afterwards. And we don't know whether that means second incursion after the flood, which I tend to put my position in, or there is somehow they survived the flood with the help of fallen angels. But these are the ones that take over the royal dynasties, and Nimrod marries into after Babel. And these are the royal dynasties that come down through history, partnered with this Babylon religion, the religion of Babel, the religion that crosses the flood that restarts at Babel. This is the feudal system that they have set up throughout history to enslave humankind and to lead them away from God and to eventually destroy them so that we cannot reach our destiny. And so when we look at prehistory, we need to match that up with prophecy so that we can understand what is going on today and why they want to bring about the end time and what is going to happen in the end time so that we're not deceived. And when Steve is talking about, you know, a whole bunch of events that are going on in prehistory, I actually think that having angels being created and rebelling before Genesis 2 makes more sense in terms of a timeline and the events that sort of roll forward. But whatever somebody's position is on that, we do know that they rebelled. We knew that they rebelled before Eden because Satan is already in there deceiving Adam and Eve, and that this has been going on for quite some time.
You know, I just want to toss in here, Genesis 6 Giants, in addition to the Genesis 6 Conspiracy. Steve Quayle wrote Genesis 6 Giants. You want some background information, that's a great book, as well as the Genesis 6 Conspiracy by Gary Wayne. Folks, I would urge you, if you're interested in this, and I think everyone is or should be, definitely get a hold of those two books, as well as the upcoming Branson Conference, to really gain a true understanding, because history is really kind of our future in this case. Steve, go ahead.
Well, one of the things too, you know, and somebody who's done movies, interviewed like literally hundreds of quote unquote experts, researchers, archaeologists, anthropologists over the years. Okay, now I'm talking 40 years. So many dug that, you know, to recall them all. But one thing is, I think is critical. Gary just made a statement, you know, where the fallen angels went before the flood. The book of Genesis says there were giants in those days before the floods and after those days. So the point is there was a second incursion of fallen angels. Now they're doing it, and I would say a third incursion, but they're doing it genetically. They're looking. The Human Genome Project was undertaken to identify the genes of the Rephaim. Rephaim and Nephilim are thrown together. You know, I make the distinction that after Numbers 1333, the term Nephilim is never used again. After that, it's Rephaim, Rapha, the dead. Why this is critical is because they're going to reanimate the giants. When a giant dies, the spirit, which is half human, half fallen angel, becomes a demon, a disembodied spirit. The disembodied spirits seek to attach, enter in, possess their old host if possible, or something in the meantime. Whether the aliens are created beings by fallen angel technology, the Golden Age, the myths, the legends of the sunken continents, obviously Atlantis being one of the most mythologically judged areas in the world, Lemuria, Mu, these are all the things that the occultists have latched on to. But it was in their own creation when even as they were ultimately created, let's say there are fallen angel civilizations, when they started manipulating animal and fallen angel DNA, just like they're now manipulating human and animal DNA, chimeras, the point is that we're just at the same point as it was in the days of Noah. The argument against the days of Noah boils down to, well, we're just talking about violence and perversion, blah, blah, blah. No, it wasn't. It was talking about the very necessity for God to send the flood of Noah to wipe out all the genetic stock that was hybridized. In other words, and only Noah and his family, not morally perfect, but genetically perfect, their generations were allowed to get out of the flood. So we know this. If there were giants before the flood and after the flood, then there had to be a second incursion after the flood. In other words, it worked once, it worked wonderfully, it worked twice. Now the angels are plotting how they're going to do it. Obviously, God is going to judge them. He drove the giants out of the promised land. King Og, one of the last really big guys, but it was interesting, Gary, I'll let you address this if you wouldn't mind. Before the flood, the giants were bigger. After the flood, they were shorter. I mean, still, if you're talking about somebody who's 18 feet tall, he's not going to be, you know, considered a small by any means. But if you go into ancient history, there are ones that go as high as 36 feet high. So, you know, what I want to do, if you don't mind, Gary, is to bring it into a, if you will, a pace. Let me take you to where, you know, some of the questions you had. I think you need to, if you would. What is your take on the reappearance of the giants physically on Earth? Do you want to address that, please?
Yeah, so I really like what you're talking about when you're talking about Jesus talking about the days of Noah. And Jesus used those words specifically as the days of Noah in Genesis 9:29 talks about the days of Noah being 600 years before the flood and 350 after the flood. So it's important we understand that as one of the broader signs. And it's more than just violence. This is the corruption and all of the different things that you were talking about, Steve. And the whole world was corrupted. And this is important to understand because the giant story, Genesis 6, 1 through 4, is the preamble to the flood story. There's nothing to separate it. It's connected. And when God says the whole world was corrupted, that's the Hebrew word shakath. That means spoiled, decayed, destroyed, ruined. And so when I talk about what the evil forces are trying to do, then we have to understand that they were trying to destroy the whole world and humankind to wipe us from the face of the earth. This is the same doctrine that crossed the flood and continues to cross the flood. In terms of the size of the giants that you're referring to, we do see a smaller kind of giant that shows up after the flood. So you take Goliath, which is in the time of King David, of course, which is, you know, thousands of years after the original creation before the flood. And when they show up, even, you know, at least 1,000 years, after the flood at the time of David, there's at least 1,000 year gap there. And Goliath is from Gath, and he is part of 5 giants that are born from a specific giant. And that's Rapha again, Rephaim for the male plural. He was listed as 6 cubits and a span. And that is by a standard common measurement is 18 inches for a common cubit, but a royal cubit is closer to 21 inches. So depending on which measurement you're going to use, Goliath was 9 feet 9 inches to 11 feet 3 inches. I think he was the larger size because he would have been the king of Gath, and David picked up 5 smooth stones and was prepared to kill all 5 kings of the Philistine Pentapolis that were represented there. But he only had to kill one. I don't think he picked up 5 stones because he thought he was going to miss. He thought he would have to kill all of the kings. And the other reference for size after the flood is King Og's bed. So his bed was 6 feet wide using the same measurements, and he would have been somewhere between, the bed would have been 15 to 16 feet tall, depending again whether or not you're using a common or a royal cubit, which would have placed him over 12 feet tall, maybe closer to 14 feet tall. And of course, his age goes back further than Goliath. So as you can see, he seems to be a bigger one, and you take from that that they were, you know, bigger even before Og. And Og was king of Bashan, and he had a brother Sihon as well. So again, royal status. So you see, as I'm linking in here, not only the size, but that these were the kings that were the ruling dynasties that took over very early in the post-diluvian world, just as they did before the flood. Now, before the flood, we have no idea how big these things actually could get to. It's typically 36 to 50 feet tall would be the average consensus of it. The other thing to remember about these monsters is that they just weren't tall. They weren't sideshow freaks. You know, there's a verse in Isaiah that talks about these mighty ones or Nephilim, as I understand it, as being stout, because the understanding was that they were significantly wider than the average human. The average human would have a height to width ratio of, let's say, 3 to 1. The Rephaim are thought to have had a 2 to 1 height to width ratio, which would have made them twice as wide. And of course, they would have been very, very gifted as warriors, and therefore very, very dexterous, quick and fast, just as the Greeks like to describe the heroes of old, that these were very, very skilled warriors and quick and fleet of foot and ambidextrous. So these were walking war machines. And then when you look at the technology that Steve was talking about, both before and after the flood, we have to take it that from that understanding, or at least as I understand it, that the level of knowledge that was developed before the flood probably exceeds what we have today, because we're not quite in the end time. We may be in the fig tree generation, but we're not in the last 7 years. So our technology and knowledge is still advancing, and yet they were able to build buildings like the pyramids or Machu Picchu and on and on and on with all these great megaliths and do things that we can't do today, which suggests a higher level of knowledge. And that starts to bring in their ability to manipulate the human genome, plant genomes, DNA, and create all of these fantastic types of beings and probably destroy the whole earth. And that's why I think God brings the animals to the arks, because he knows which ones are not spoiled or corrupted, and is going to restart with a completely pure line of animals and humans after the flood. But our knowledge is still developing, so that there'll be this war that happens that precedes the flood, because in all parallel accounts outside the Bible, you have a rebellion against God that includes a war against the gods. So there was this war that was going on, and I think that war was more, as we understand it, biblically against humankind. And the technology that they had is what we're working towards now. And this technology is advanced in the antediluvian epoch, as the book of Enoch talks about, or as all accounts around the world will talk about from the gods, that this knowledge is given to humankind. And in Enoch, it talks about the knowledge of the fallen angels being given to Cain and Enoch, and the seven sciences that they had already developed that accelerated this knowledge, which caused a need to create the mystical religions and the secret societies all before prehistory. And this is what we're catching up to today, so that the fallen angels can make a case to humans and deceive us that we can actually have the weapons and the power to stand against the evil God of the Bible as they represent them, not as I represent God, but as they view God, so that they can rebel and win a realm of our own, just as most of their, you know, occult literature will talk about.
I'm gonna jump in here with a question. I know it's gonna come up, and I wanna just offset the question with this by asking the question that's gonna come up. Very simply, since God is omnipotent in control, why not just, as soon as the uprising of rebellion, whatever began, when I say whatever, I'm just trying to be all inclusive here. Why didn't he just say, okay, enough, you know, you're done. We're going to start, because omnipotent power, all powerful, start over, you know, or take him out.
Go ahead and answer that, Gary.
Oh, I'll take that on. Love to take that one on. It's such a great question. So the first thing we need to understand is that we have an all powerful Alpha Omega beginning and end God. So he knows everything. So nothing's ever going to surprise him. He knows the beginning from the end. And he also believes that, I think, that we need to make our choices through free choice and to choose to follow God. So as we look at the different creations, we have the creations of the angels and the creations of the humans. And first, the angels are created, and they're already created immortal. They don't have a choice to be immortal, but they have immortal granted to them. But they do know God intimately. But God knows right from the beginning that they're going to have free choice, and many are going to choose to rebel. And of course, Satan does, and up to a third rebel. And so God then creates humankind as an answer to that rebellion. And he's going to create humankind to be raised above angels in the future time. But they're going to have not be created mortal in the beginning, even though Adam and Eve initially have access to the tree of life. But they're going to be created mortal and without complete intimate knowledge of God. And humankind are going to have to choose God through free choice to want to be raised into the future world. So what we have going on here is free choice playing out. So God knows everything that's going to happen. The angels don't know everything God knows. And so the angels come along and they start to take the revenge, starting in Eden, inclusive of, you know, Cain killing Abel and starting this opposing lineage in Genesis and working with the fallen angels. You have Genesis 6. You have the destruction and corruption of the entire world. You have Babel after the flood. You have, you know, Satan trying to entice Jesus at the time he's in the desert, and he's at his sort of weakest physical point. As I mentioned earlier, they don't anticipate the crucifixion. So that ultimately will seal their fate to go to the lake of fire, angels at the end of the end time, and then Satan at the end of the 1,000 years or the millennium. But God loves us so much, he is allowing this all to play out through free choice, but he is greater than free choice. And no one will be able to stand up and say, angel or human, that we didn't freely choose.
Well, and then I think that, Doug, is really the whole issue of free will. Even within Christianity, there are the thoughts of predestination, foreknowledge, etc. But free will existed in the angels because they chose one third of the angels to basically fall and follow Lucifer, resulting in their fall. Now, one third is interesting because obviously Jesus talked about his angels. It says the devil and his angels. And then God has his holy angels. It's kind of a neat play on words there, Gary. But the thing that's interesting is the angels had to choose whether to believe and stay in the realm that God created them initially in, or to take on something that was forbidden to them, the forbidden fruit of earth women. Now, it wasn't just because, you know, earth women are easy. And they looked down and saw, boy, those are some. It was because they wanted to destroy the seed. They wanted to take on the promise of God. Could they wipe out genetically the entire human race? Then the promised Redeemer could not come. So it's always been a question of seed. Right now, and I will say this, I don't think anybody can make a statement against what I'm going to make. The plan through transhumanism and singularity and achieving godhood apart from the living God is to basically do away with humanity. That's what a transhumanist believes, that God did a really bad job and that mankind, in their rebellion, their knowledge, their anger, their angst, their ego, can make a better, not a mousetrap, but a better entity. And it's interesting, Doug, that it all centers around sex. The procreative gifting that God gave to Adam and Eve to go out and to multiply is now being challenged by all of the sexuality, all of the emasculations, all of the transgender. Just remember this, transgender and transhumanism, it's not that they just share the first, five letters. It's that means a cross. So across the board, as I'm applying it to the statement, the design is to destroy all mankind, so much so that Jesus said if he didn't shorten the days, there'd be no flesh left alive. Yet for the elect's sake, that's those of us redeemed by the blood of the Lamb, you know, those days are being shortened. And that's why, Doug, you know, tomorrow you'll go, where did last year go? Maybe the following day you'll go, man, where did the last 2 years go? Everybody is having a compression of time. And I don't know, Gary, if you're noticing it too. But just think back 5 years and think back, can I account for every minute of that? No. Can you account for maybe every month of that? Maybe. I doubt it. Maybe you can account for every couple months or the seasons. But God is speeding up the time. And so it is a redemptive plan of a living God to help his people, not literally to get wiped out, because the Lord himself said his people are destroyed. That means glitched. You're gone. You're the end is put to you for lack of knowledge. So that's why the Genesis 6 conspiracy is a multi-dimensional conspiracy. It takes place in heaven. It takes place on earth. It takes place in the seen realms, the unseen realms. It involves things that we have not yet seen, but will see. It involves the giants are coming in Isaiah 13:3 and the Septuagint to fulfill God's wrath, and he says, behold, I send them. So when people say, why didn't God? That was one of my first questions. Well, why didn't you just do away with it? And then I go to the book of, when Moses is standing before God, and God says, stand aside, Moses, and wipe them out. I said, good thing I wasn't Moses, and I'm not liking myself, because I was a, yep, that's a good idea, Lord. Let's start over, okay? So Moses was a meekest man of the earth, and he interceded to God. But right now, every principality, every fallen angel, every evil, malevolent, demon, disembodied spirit, every form of wickedness is absolutely taking place in the earth. And its design is one thing, to destroy all mankind, creating the image and likeness of God, to bring about a Uberman, Nietzsche called him Ubermensch, Superman. And that means with no foothold in the past, God's creation, a totally new, what Russ calls, Russ Dizdar calls, Homo Satanicus. Go ahead.
Yeah, hold it right there. We're going to have to take a network break at the top of the hour. You're listening to Steve Quayle, stevequayle.com. Folks, go to the program description links. The only place you're going to find them is at HagmanReportLive.com, HagmanReportLive.com. And in the program description box, click on through to both Genesis 6 Giants, the upcoming Branson Conference, and also the Genesis 6 Conspiracy. Going to be right back. You're listening to Hagman, where truth can't be silenced. Stay right where you're at.
Reporting on what the mainstream media won't, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network.
And welcome back to Hagman. It's the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. The first hour with Gary... Well, I was looking at you, Eric. Folks, you got to see the backstage theatrics here. The audio only today because of the still rebuilding things up from, you know, the unfortunate water incident. Gary Wayne, I thought you were going to tell me something different, but that's why I hesitated there. And Steve Quayle. But Steve Quayle, we're going to let him go because there's some communications issues there. So it's just going to be Gary and I this next hour. All right. So, all right. A lot of news. Now, I point everyone to HagmanReportLive.com, HagmanReportLive.com, as well as HagmanReport.com as well. A lot of news taking place, of course, in the political realm. Some think, oh, that's just theater. Yeah, it is. It is, but still it's stuff that people are talking about. And, of course, with President Trump, what's going on there, the pardons which he issued. You know, by the way, the pardons are far less significant than, go back to Clinton. Go back to Clinton. All right. Just need I say more before we get back to the program. I want to mention, you know, folks, online shopping, I never realized how much shopping you can do online. All right. Silly me. Well, that's because I'm old. You know that Honey is the free online shopping tool that automatically finds the best promo codes and applies them to your cart. And you know how great it feels to save. But how does it feel to save with Honey? I'm going to tell you, saving with Honey feels like slipping into, oh my goodness, a nice warm bed on a cold night. It just, I'm going to tell you something. It is comforting to me to know that I can save. And that's right. My wife, she clips coupons. She uses Honey. I use Honey for online shopping. And Eric the Tech does too and uses Honey. I'm telling you. The studio equipment is offset. In fact, Eric bought a piece of equipment and saved $60 on one piece of electronic equipment. That's how much you can save with Honey. I'm telling you, $60. And it was easy. Folks, Honey has found it's over 18 million members, over $2 billion. That's right, billion dollars in savings. Did you know that Honey supports over 30,000 stores online? Talk about Macy's, Target, Sephora, Best Buy, more. And they're adding more stores every day. And users love Honey. That's why it's over 100,000 plus 5-star reviews on the Google. I can do this. Google Chrome Store. Or Google Chrome Store. Now, we better go with Google Chrome Store, right? Folks, here's what you need to do. Using Honey, it does feel pretty good. It feels pretty great, actually. Think of it as a little daily victory. Plus, it's free to use and installs in just a few seconds. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/Hagman. That's joinhoney.com/Hagman. And two N's on Hagman, please. All right. Use Honey. It feels pretty great. And again, think of it as a little daily victory. I do. Joinhoney.com/Hagman. Two N's on Hagman. All right. So, a lot of stuff going on. And I want to just to just to, in case you missed the first hour, just to tell you that we were off air last night because the construction workers cut through our internet lines and it took a long time to get back up again and running. So I want to thank you for your patience and back with a great program. Gary Wayne. Have you been listening to, did you catch the first hour? If you didn't catch the first hour, go back and listen. And now Gary's going to be speaking at Branson. And I want to tell you something. His knowledge about prehistory history, incredible. So with that, Gary Wayne. Gary, thanks for coming back.
Well, looking forward to the second half. And so sorry, Steve isn't with us, but I think
we're going to knock it off
some things. We're going to knock it out of the park.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, going into this Gary, I know that you don't know the backstory behind this, but we had some water issues here and in the studio. And it was so messed up because we thought we had taken care of it last week, but this week it came back again and the construction workers and contractors are looking at this and saying, what's going on, man? It's crazy. And, anyway, so in the repair of that, or once it was determined what was wrong, the internet cable was cut, so we couldn't do our show. And the reason I bring all this up is because we had audio problems with Steve. We're only on audio now. And, you know, if I was biblically minded and conspiratorial, I'd say, man, there's something really strange going on that doesn't want to get our message out. But, anyway, that's the backstory. But yeah, we're going to hit it out of the park. So where you left off, wherever you want to go, let's go.
Yeah, let's go. So, you know, one of the things that Steve had brought up that I had, hadn't circled back around to was the idea of, you know, marriage in heaven. And when Matthew talks about that, in terms of, and that being used for why these can't be the sons of God in Genesis 6. So I really want to sort of touch on that just to sort of begin with. And
now it's a party. You're going to have people talking about this. So marriage in heaven. So you're,
yeah.
Okay. Now people will say, well, there's no marriage. It can't be marriage in heaven. No marriage in heaven, right? Is that your position? Yeah.
Well, there isn't any marriage in heaven, according to what Matthew talks about, but that doesn't mean there isn't marriage on earth, and we know that, and that doesn't mean that angels can't take a form on earth, because they're spirit beings in heaven, and they're created immortal. They have no requirement to reproduce. They're immortal. Humans are not. We have a requirement to reproduce. And so people say, you know, well, extend that because there's no marriage in heaven with angels, they are not able to have marriage or reproduce on the earth. And they'll extend to that the idea that they're a spirit being and spirit can't intermix with humankind, except that, you know, Genesis 6 would obviously testify against that. But there's nothing to say that they can't take a physical form. And in fact, in the Bible, we get significant accounts of angels taking a physical form, whether or not it's angels that look like humans that we don't recognize as angels, as in the time of Abraham, or the ones that are recognized as angels at Sodom, even though they look like humans. They come in giant forms, as in Daniel talked about, great shining beings. And they appear as Gabriel does to announce when Jesus is going to be born. And these are all physical forms in the physical world. And just as Jude 1:6 talks about, these are the ones who left their habitation. Habitation goes back to this word oikoterion, which is defined as a dwelling place for the spirit. So they left their place for their dwelling place for the spirit. And seemingly they would have taken on a physical form or a dwelling place for their spirit while in the physical world so that they can interact physically with the world. And again, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, we get the same word being used is this house in heaven that is reserved for us. It's a dwelling place for our spirit. And so there's a requirement for the spirit that comes from God, the spirit that is embedded into us when God breathed into Adam that makes us different and requires a dwelling place for a spirit. And so to interact, you need to have us a physical form. So now when we look at demons, as Jesus talks about these demons that he is casting out of people, Legion and all the other accounts that we get in the New Testament, he talks about these demons as being in dry places and thirsting, and they're always looking to possess, because the bodiless spirits of the demons are the spirits of the immortal Nephilim after their bodies die, and they weren't allowed to go to sleep, and they weren't allowed to go to heaven, and they thirst for a body to interact in the physical world. And this is really, really important, because as we look towards where we're heading into the end time, is we're going to have demons not only around in the end time, and somehow I think Nephilim are going to be part of the end time, whether or not they're recreated, or it's the descendants, as I write about in my book, or that there are ones that are going to be awakened or reactivated. However they come about, I believe they're going to impact the end time in a significant way, as will the demons. And the demons require a body to interact in the end time.
Okay,
so when we see all of this,
can I ask you a question? Do you have to invite demons? Like, could I be walking down the street and all of a sudden, you know, bam, you know, I'm demon possessed, or do you have to invite them in, or is it? Or I don't mean to make light of this. I'm just asking.
Well, I think typically they need to be invited, but they seduce you to invite them. So I think people of the polytheist religions actively will invite them to, in hoping that they're going to receive additional power and knowledge, as in the sort of the crazy clown shaman ideology in polytheism. But that's got another rabbit hole.
Sorry, I didn't mean to divert you, but I just was thinking about that.
Yeah, now. That's a good point.
You know, so okay, go ahead, continue.
Well, and what's important about all of this is that demons are going to not only take place in the end time, and I think our technology that we were talking about in the first half, whether it's the development of clones or transhumanism or robotics or bionics, all the different technologies that's intermarrying with AI and things, I do believe that they're creating a dwelling place for the spirit of the bodiless Nephilim to enter into in the end time so that they can be active as well. So we may have the old ones being active in these bodies that they're providing us knowledge to create for them going into the end time. And then one of the things I also wanted to touch on, when I was talking about the prehistorical part in the first half of the show, and we talked about, I just quickly mentioned the seraphim angels, and it's very interesting that this is an important order that we have to keep in mind as we talk about prehistory and we talk about things going forward, because it's one of the most powerful order of angels that's around the throne that people like to talk about as watchers. And what's interesting about the seraphim angels, and you can see this in Isaiah 6 if you want to look, you know, read verses 1 through 6 on the seraphim, is that when you take seraphim back to Hebrew, it's the word seraph and the I am, the male plural again, but it's defined as a fiery serpent being or angel. And so it's these serpent-like angels that are part of the watchers that are core to the angelic rebellion and all of this serpentine imagery and things that we see around the earth about the gods, whether or not it's in Egypt with Ogdoad gods or it's in Sumeria or it's, you know, it's one of these things that are all around the world. The dragon creators out of China. In antiquity, the serpent and the dragon were the same. And understood as the same. And when you have a serpent with wings, that's a dragon. And a seraphim with wings is a dragon angelic being, or as the Chinese, a dragon creator would call them. But we also see this show up around the world as nagas, which are kind of these feathered types of serpent beings. And with the plume serpent and the feathered serpent in with the Kishamaya and their religious history. And these are the same beings, and these are part of those watchers of the sons of God, and why we have all of this serpentine imagery around the world, and why you have the royal dynasties and the bloodlines of the Rephaim after the flood taking their iconology and their genealogies back to the Nephilim, back to the Rephaim, back to the fallen angels, and complete with that serpentine dragon iconology that sort of holds in a taciturn sense their history and their genealogies.
Okay. All right. And that makes sense to me. And folks, you know, all of this discussion, I want to tell you something. All right. The one book, and you know how much I like to read, folks. I've got a vast library. The Genesis 6 conspiracy lays out what we're talking about in a larger sense in a way that I can understand it. And if I can understand it, I know you can. So folks, go to Genesis6conspiracy.com. It's going to be the link in the program description box. And get the book by Gary Wayne. And it's available on Amazon too. But if you treasure signed copies, you'll sign them, right? You'll sign the book?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And if you didn't want a signed copy, if you wanted to buy it, from Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com or the Kindle version, I've got links on my website there as well. And I'll give people a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters on the website. So you'll get a good feel for whether or not you like the book or not.
All right. Perfect. Yeah. And thank you for doing that. Because, you know, this is one of the subjects that when I look at this, I can see why, and especially after reading the Genesis 6 conspiracy, by the way, thank you very much, and thanks for writing the book. But after reading about this, I can see why it's of importance today and why we need to be paying attention to what happened in history, prehistory, history, and today. So thank you. Okay. So go ahead. And that interesting about the serpentry that what you just said, this is kind of all kind of falling into place now. So go continue.
Yeah, so, and this is that organizational structure that I was talking about, and this is the common heritage that we have that comes out of prehistory and comes out of the early post-Diluvian history. And it's not that it's isolated to the Bible. This is a worldwide global legacy. You have names of these giants that come out of, subcontinent of India. You know, they have several names like the Danua and the Daitya and the Zura. And you have the heroes and the titans of Greek mythology. You have the Myosi of the Chinese, legends and mythology. You have the Anunnaki and the ringlords of the Sumerian, mythology. And of course, you know, Gilgamesh, who's created after the flood, and up Pishtun, who is the archetypical Nephilim in the Nephilim survival story of the Epic of Gilgamesh. You know, they give you a second incursion and a survival story all in the same epic. But those are, when I talk about the Sumerian Anunnaki, those are what I'm talking about. Now, they're described as one-third human and two-thirds God, but it's still, they're the offspring of the gods. And you have the Xibalba out of the Kishamaya and the Popol Vuh. You have the Tengu that are a little bit different looking. These are the types of Nephilim that have a bird or a raven face. And the Tengu come from the Tengu gods, which, you know, are similar to the dragon gods, but another order of angels. And all of these things, whether or not you have the giants or the pyramids or the flood story, are all part of this ancient, global, history that people all intrinsically understand, but at different levels, but nobody really sort of pursues because it's always said to be just myth. But right. You just can't have that kind of myth with that many nexus points all around the world. The only continent we don't have these stories coming from and these types of structures is Antarctica, and who knows what's in Antarctica.
Yeah, that's okay. All right. So Okay. Judging from what we saw in the prehistory history, are we looking at our future? Is that kind of where we're at?
Well, we are, because nothing is new under the sun.
Right.
And the story has been recycling. So the end time is just the ultimate rendezvous with destiny. It's the ultimate rebellion. Humankind is going to be deceived into standing with these polytheist religions, their gods, their fallen angels, and the demons against the God of the Bible. And most people think that, or don't understand that, it is the spurious polytheist forces that want to bring about the end time, because they're listening to these fallen angels. And the religion that they developed is a dualistic religion, and it has several meanings in that, but at its core is there's this yin and yang, this good versus evil, that is equal and in perpetual conflict. And in that thought process and that doctrine, they teach their followers that Satan is the equal of God, the yin and the yang, and that they can win if they rebel against God, and they can have their own realm with Satan having his own throne to be like God ruling over them. That's the deception that they're teaching humankind in through these religions and their offshoot secret societies, which is part of that same religious organizational structure that partners with the bloodlines of the Rephaim and is preparing the world for the end time. So they want this rendezvous with destiny because they've been deceived that they can win. The stumbling block is always those who are loyal to God, the true God. And that's why we're going to have two genocides in the end time, one in the first 3.5 years with the Babylon religion, and then the second one with the Antichrist in the last 3.5 years. And everything that is taking place in the end time is going to be connected back to the end time in terms of understanding its meaning and many of the players. So if you want to understand what's going to happen and what is happening, you have to understand the players.
And we saw the players, but we're seeing the players now. I'm trying to phrase a question here. You know, with the secret societies you mentioned, the bloodlines, everything you mentioned in the first hour, is so important, I believe, that we're seeing right now. And are we not seeing this, how would you describe it? Well, you described it in your book, the Genesis 6 conspiracy. But how would you describe it to the listeners and viewers today, in terms of today, what's happening today?
So the core is always what it looks like before. So they need to set up the new world order, as I heard you mentioning, introducing the show, which is the world government. And they need this universal religion. So the players are setting this up today. They're working feverishly for it. And they're being controlled, sponsored, funded by the polytheists and the bloodlines and all the wealth and everything that they have. So when you look at the World Council of Churches, that the Catholic Church is working with to, you know, compromise doctrine to come with one doctrine. When you see, you know, a Jesuit pope that is going to discuss with the Buddhists and the Muslims on how they can bring this together, this is laying that format for bringing all of this about. And this is going to be that universal religion that they're going to bring about. Now, they're going to need some catalysts and catastrophes to scare people into the Babel syndrome, as I like to talk about it, and hence why it's called the Babylon religion. But this is what they're actively working for, and they're trying to recreate the structure that was before the flood. And Francis Bacon, who is a Rosicrucian, and wrote New Atlantis and is inspirational founder to the Royal Society and, has his picture hung in the entranceway as the inspirational founder for his writings, and in particular the New Atlantis. He names it the New Atlantis because Atlantis was this golden age, this golden civilization before the flood. And Atlantis is an identical story to Genesis 6 with a god Poseidon having sex with a female, in some accounts as iapetus, but it's the same story. So Climene or Clito, and they produced 10 Nephilim kings of the antediluvian Atlantis empire, according to Timaeus and Critias by Plato. And they're going to try and take over the world, and they're considered the helm of world government. This is what they're trying to recreate, because when you look at the new Atlantis for the end time, and you look, match that up with Daniel, with the 10 horns and the 10 kings and the 10 toes, and with Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, it's the same number. And the right. Club of Rome, to link one more dot in, which links in and reports to either the upper half of the Rosicrucians or the Committee of 300, which are pure bloods that are at the top of the secret societies. And the Rosicrucian is that sort of nexus point between the lower secret societies and the upper royal blood orders. The Committee of 300 was set up, or the Club of Rome was set up in the late 60s to establish 10 spheres of countries, 10 trading blocks, 10 groups of countries for the end time. So they're feverishly working to put this together so that they can bring about the last 7 years. They would set all of this up, the New World Order, the Universal Government, on their own time if they could, and they continue to try. But there's an ordained time, and until the restrainer is removed, they're going to have to wait no matter what they do, and that's why they get setbacks, like in Brexit or perhaps with Trump and other things that are going on around the world. But they will accept the ordained times if they have to, and of course they will.
Okay. And folks, we're talking with Gary Wayne, author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy. That's Genesis 6, the number 6, conspiracy.com, Genesis number 6, conspiracy.com. The book is also available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, but if you want a signed copy, go to Genesis number 6, conspiracy.com. And Gary Wayne's the author of that book, Genesis 6, Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. And he said it too, go to Genesis 6, conspiracy.com, link in the program description box at HagmanReportLive.com for generous excerpts from the book. Your book, by the way, it's an excellent summary of the link between groups like the Illuminati, the Freemasons, what people refer to as aliens, and of course the Nephilim, the biblical, non-biblical, texts. This is understandable for anyone, and I thank you for writing it. So, back to what you're saying, the bloodlines are important here, is it not? I mean, we're talking about bloodlines in terms of the current iteration of the leadership of the world, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And when we, to give a sort of an understanding of what we're talking about, and even though some of the royal families aren't as visible today, they're still working in the background. But if you go back 100 years in World War One, you have, the throne of England fighting against the throne of Germany, which is fighting against the throne of Russia, and the Germany is partnered with the Habsburgs out of Austria. And what I'm basically saying here is you have basically an internal family civil war, because they're all cousins, because they continue to intermarry throughout the millennia to keep their bloodlines as pure as possible, and with Scion grafted in bloodlines to increase their nobility, because in terms of where they fit in the hierarchy of the cult of the bloodlines, the purer and the more ennobled bloodlines places yourself in that position.
All right. And that makes sense to me. I mean, I've heard about the bloodlines. I've heard about the Illuminati. I've heard about the Freemasons. I've heard about all of these. But now that makes sense to me. So often, and maybe I'm kind of going off stream here, off road, shall we say? But people talk about the descendants of Cain. Is that something that you address? In other words, the Keynesian line that this is kind of coming from, or is that a different theory?
It's part of the same web, and that's what's so crazy about what we're talking about, is that the conspiracy or the organizational structure in Leviathan is so old and so large, it, you just want to sit, you know, take a step back and say, no, it can't be true. But then you start to see and connect things that you see out there every day. So, you know, Cain, from a human standpoint, is a significant patriarch of Gnosticism and secret societies, understanding that Gnosticism is the religion of the secret societies. His son Cain is a significant patriarch. As I mentioned in the first half of the show, Enoch develops the knowledge that Cain receives from Adam and develops and puts it into the seven liberal sciences. And what he's doing, and this is, comes right out of the History of Freemasonry by Albert Mackey, he's putting this information into those seven disciplines, and the ideology is to lead people away from God, because Cain has rebelled and he has not forgiven God for ostracizing him, and he's in a state of rebellion and open to be manipulated by the fallen angels even more. And so the knowledge is designed to not give God credit for anything, and it's to degrade God in all possible ways, and it's to build monuments to the pantheon of gods. And that's why when I mentioned the Royal Society, which is the modern wedge to education and science, it has the same basis and premise and from the same belief system, and in their belief system, the descendants of Nephilim, who the Canaanites are going to intermarry with. So the daughters in Genesis 6 are the daughters of the Canaanites, who have been well prepared to take part in this action of creating to the giants. And it's these seven sciences that Enoch develops. And of course, the Masons say that Enoch's knowledge was used to build the pyramids and those other great megaliths that, you know, we were talking about previously. But this is the descendants that are going to intermarry with the sons of God, and the knowledge is going to intermix with the knowledge coming down from heaven that will accelerate the antediluvian world into the end time, just as I think we're seeing that same acceleration of what's going on today. And so, again, as Steve was talking about in the first half, whether or not it is a new man that the Nazis call it, whether or not it's some sort of transhumanism, some sort of combination, or an actual recreation or an awakening of these giants, we're going to see these things in the end time again. So the Canaanites are a significant part. And as you get into the Cain line, you get another name that crosses over in the lines with Lamech. And Lamech is the father of Nama, Tubal-Cain, Jabal, and Jubal. And
right.
Tubal-Cain. These are great these are patriarchs of ancient Masonic history, and are reveled and honored even to this day. And Tubal-Cain is the great artificer of metals in the secret societies and the belief system. And all of these are showing a small reflection in the Bible of that knowledge, and with Tubal-Cain with metals and with the descriptions of Jubal and Jubal, but they're hoisted up to a high level of a renaissance of these, of this knowledge that has intermarried with the knowledge coming from the fallen angels at that period of time. And that's the time of the days of Noah, and that's the time of the creation of the giants. And in their belief system, Nama intermarries with the giants as one of the daughters to create, or intermarries with the fallen angels as one of the daughters to create giants.
Okay. Wow, man, this is fantastic. The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, that's the book website, Genesis6Conspiracy.com. That's the website there. You can find just generous amounts of information, along with all of Gary Wayne's interviews, or many excerpts of Gary, many of Gary Wayne's interviews, I should say. And I love it. I could spend days, and I think maybe have spent a day at your website. So I appreciate what you do. I feel like it kind of maybe took you off track, and I didn't mean to do that by my questions. Maybe one more question, and then you can resume on track if you don't mind. Is there today, are we looking, how do we know, how can we identify people from, we'll say, that bloodline, the, for lack of a better term, broad stroke, bad bloodline? Can we identify them in any sense by their appearance, by their actions? Well, by their appearance, or is that too academic of a question?
No, it's not too academic of a question, and I think it's a very, very good question. You know, what we see today, we don't see what the giants looked like in the past, even though that they are descendants of. And I think that's because they've had to introduce outside bloodlines to prevent blood diseases like Habsburg jaw and hemophiliac disease and all the other blood diseases. But they do always do things in plain sight in terms of their language that they speak in, whether it's 1,000 points of light or it is talking about the New World Order, or it's talking about, you know, the doctrines of catastrophe in terms of apocalyptic things like global warming and stuff to scare people into the Babel syndrome. And more importantly, in their more taciturn kinds of display, because they like to do a couple of things. One is to, you know, put out there what they're going to do. So that shows up in all of their literature, but their names and their iconology will reflect who they are. So if you're looking at company names, or if you're looking at symbols, or if you're looking at buildings, look for things that will identify them. I mean, obviously, if you see some sort of dragon or beast-like thing on a government building or a church, you know, you need to be focused on that. Like, there's something going on there. If there's a Masonic square there, there's probably some sort of relationship there. But whether it's the scales of justice or the blindness, I mean, all of this goes back into allegories coming out of prehistory, and they're going to advertise who they are.
Oh, no. Now, wait a second. I've got a lady justice with scale, holding a scale, blindfolded, holding the scales. Now, do I need to get rid of that? I mean, if you could, and I'm being serious about this. I'm dead serious about this.
The thing I would say is that unless you're participating in those rituals and things, then you really probably don't have anything to worry about. I mean, we are immersed in a world that is run by the fallen angels until the end time and by their representatives on earth. We can't escape everything, but we want to make sure that we're not participating in those kind of rituals, even though we may not be understanding them as rituals, because they take over so many of our holidays. You know, they have you swear oaths in court. We just need to be aware of what they're doing and try and be as separate, you know, from that as we can. It's just like a lot of people say, is knowledge bad from what you talk about? No, knowledge isn't bad. It's what you do with it that's bad.
Very well stated. And but boy, I got to admit, because this is out there, and I am the subject of this vast, people are looking at me and saying, hey, you know something? This guy's bad. Hagman's bad. Mr. Wayne, I graduated from a Jesuit seminary. Okay, a minor seminary. This is back 40 plus years ago now. And I have to say this, I never heard the word Jesuit. I didn't know what it was then, and now I do, but I never, you know, I never took an oath. The day I graduated was the last time I really, until this program, ever heard the word Jesuit. So, hey, I'm coming clean with you, brother. So am I an assassin, or am I, you know, am I okay or what?
Well, I would say that you still have obviously the ability to think for yourself and critically think. So you've not been brainwashed. I mean,
check, right?
Okay. Whether or not it's inside the Catholic Church or outside the Catholic Church, these powerful forces have control over education.
Okay. And right? I believe that. Yeah. Of course they do.
And they show a little bit of that. You know, when you graduate high school, you get a degree.
Yes.
Well, degrees is that, as in, let's say, the 33rd degrees of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, the higher you go, the greater degree you get. And they give you a graduation ceremony with black hats coming out of grade 12 and other ceremonies in universities. And the schools and the universities tend to have all of this sort of Greek classical Masonic architecture. I mean, they control this because they planned it. And so what they try and do is control the information. So the Jesuits, for example, are kind of another branch of the secret societies, but working within the Catholic Church. And so after the fall of the Knights Templar, the secret societies and the bloodlines are trying to create another organization within the Catholic Church to do what the Templars did. And also they're not going to have everything centralized as they did with the Templars, because the Templars were just this monstrous, powerful organization, from banking to literature to armies to on and on and on in terms of all the things that they were involved in. And so, you know, right after the fall of the Templars, you get 33, and they call themselves the Invisible Ones. Mm. In 1317, they're going to sit down with the Pope and say, okay, the Templars went sideways. We know that, but we want to reestablish the Knights Templar within the church. And so the Pope comes back and says, yes, we're going to do that, but none of your people are going to be members. They're all going to be part of, you know, the Christian church and people that I'm going to appoint. And the 33 say, no, we're not going to do that. And these are all royal bloodlines out of the royal families, these 33. And they get their opportunity in the 1500s with the Jesuits, with Ignatius of Loyola. And he is going to be sponsored by the leader of the Order of Montesa, whose last name is Borgia, just as you have other Borgias that were previous to him who were popes, and he's the descendant of those popes. And he's going to fund them. And the Order of Montesa is set up in 1307 to control the assets of the Templars after the fall of the Templars, but the assets just in Spain, because there's assets all over Europe, and they all go in sort of different directions. And so Borgia, as the Grand Master of the Montesa Order, is sponsoring Ignatius of Loyola. Lo and behold, by 1570, he becomes the third leader of the Jesuit society, and they've set up what they call the New Templars in the Catholic Church, and they get control of education. And with the help of the King of Spain, the Jesuits are going to get control of the banking out of Rome, and they're going to move that to Switzerland, where the Knights of St. John already welcome money from the Templars, and that's why you have the White Cross with the banking, but that's another rabbit hole. And so you have the Jesuits, who are the New Templars, set up within the church, and in the document set down by Master Rosslyn in the Constitution for the Knights Templar, their job was to set up the new Babylon within the Roman Church. And so the Jesuits aren't the all-powerful secret society that people like to raise them up to. They are part of the organizational structure of the secret societies that will report into the Rosicrucians, and perhaps the leaders up to the Committee of 300, as they're the ones who originally created them. And above the Committee of 300 is, you guessed it, the Council of 33 Invisible Ones, and the Royal Society is also called the Invisible College, which they helped create with the Freemasons in 1660.
Wow. Okay, and that explains a heck of a lot, and I thank you for taking the time out to explain that. I didn't mean to get you off track. I could talk to you all day long, and I'm sure people could listen to you all day long. This is great. The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, folks, I highly urge you to grab a hold of, get a copy of that book, and see Gary Wayne in Branson, of course, this year. My goodness. Okay, so there, what you said earlier, these people, these bloodlined, they're laughing at us through their symbolism, through all of these symbolism, actions, ceremonies, they're laughing at us, aren't they? It's right in front of us.
They consider us mundane, not worthy to know, and that we are inferior beings. They are our superiors based on their genealogies that they keep and they track. So at the end of time, they're going to come out and show these bloodlines and their genealogies, whether they're 100% true or not. They're still going to present them as their credibility to what they're doing. And Antichrist is going to be part of that as part of the mix. But yes, they're laughing at us because there's not room for the mundane in the new age or the new Atlantis. And that's why they're going to wipe us out through genocide. You know, when you look at the Rosicrucian guidestones down in Georgia, they have room for 500 people. They only have room for people and only want people that will be in their new age that have the bloodlines, whether or not that is Rh negative or not, but they're bloodlines that they can actually prove, and or the gene of Isis, as they like to talk about, which would be the technology, not the technology, but the biochemistry that would be, you know, sustain the bloodline, whatever that is, if it's of a specific kind like the Rh negative, and or the spark of the divine, as they like to call it. And the spark of the divine is that spark that comes from the immortal angels and the sons of God in Genesis 6, and then in the second incursion, as I fall into in terms of how the giants show up after the flood, that has passed on, that they want to unite in this harmonic conversion under world government and the world religion so that they can evolve into godhood, that they require this as part of their doctrine. And they're telling us this all of the time. We're just not understanding the language and or the iconology that they're presenting it in.
And that's a great point. They are telling us, but we're not listening, or we don't understand what we're seeing. Or even worse, there's this misinterpretation of what we're seeing, and kind of presented as, pardon the expression, gospel, when in fact it's not, it's anything but. So I really appreciate this deep explanation. So what we're seeing today is the setup, the run up to the Antichrist, the end of days, everything that we've read about and heard about. We're seeing it kind of develop today, aren't we?
We're seeing the final preparation things. That's why I think we're in the generation of the fig tree. And that I think, you know, Jerusalem is the key, and we don't know whether a generation is 70 years or 120 years, or some people might even use 40 years. And so we can't be too dogmatic on the timing, but we can certainly see things coming together as being on the horizon for the end time.
Wow. Okay. Now, your thought, okay, I heard this once, and I apologize for kind of hijacking this interview. I heard this said that we're going to be presented with a fake savior, and that fake savior is going to really be, there's going to be a lot of discussion about the bloodline, the bloodlines, plural. Have you heard that, or can you expand on that, or am I off base on that? A fake savior, bloodlines.
Yeah, the secret societies and the royal families want to present a bloodline as their credibility and pedigree for the Antichrist. And so there's competing bloodlines. We don't know which one is going to be, but there could be one, there'll be competing ones all around the world, because there's bloodlines that descend down from China with the Li family, with where Xi Peng comes from. You have the Yamamoto dynasty. You've still got all the bloodlines that were here in Central and South America, even after the Spanish killed the original kings, but not all of the relatives, and of course they were reestablished into noble status, by about 1530 anyways. So, you have these competing bloodlines, and that's why they keep that as part of their history and genealogies and credibility for the end time. And Antichrist will have very noble bloodlines. And it's interesting that he's called, you know, in the end time, the son of perdition, and he is going to be crowned at the abomination in the temple to mark the last, three and a half years. And all of this is kind of important, especially if you're following certain bloodlines. Now, in the famous Merovingian bloodline that they also scion in, according to their belief system, not mine, descendants of Jesus and Mary Magdalene,
yes,
because they believe Jesus didn't die on the cross. That's their belief, not mine, but a whole bunch of other scion Nephilim bloodlines. You know, these are the bloodlines that were the ancestors of de Bouillon, de Peon, and Anjou, three of the Knights Templars that found the Knights Templar. And Baldwin II is crowned in a small priory on a rock in Zion in 1118 in the Abbey de Notre Dame as the first king of Jerusalem. One of the bloodlines that they also scion in is the King Saul bloodline through Benjamites, through two versions, Mary Magdalene and the other one through Benjamites, who moved up into the Danube River, into the Cambrian area around where France is, and intermarried into the Merovingian bloodline from there. That's important to them because Joshua awards Jerusalem to the Benjamites towards the end of the conquest of the Promised Land. And so Baldwin is crowned the King of Jerusalem. This is a title that follows down their bloodlines of a certain European sets of bloodlines, that went to, the kings of Lorraine and the double cross of Lorraine that is very, very famous in history, in French history. And then the Lorraine dynasty marries into the Habsburg dynasty and they become the Habsburg-Lorraine dynasty, and they carry this double cross iconology and the King of Jerusalem title with them. And today it's held by, the King of Spain, King Philippe, inherited by Juan Carlos. And this is the crown of the King of Jerusalem that they want, at least from their push as to who Antichrist would be, will be crowned King of Jerusalem at the abomination. So this is why bloodlines and pedigree is so important to them. It's part of building the false Messiah, the counterfeit Messiah. Just as everything they're going to do is going to counterfeit things to give Antichrist that pedigree, including a counterfeit Armageddon.
Thank you. Yes, and this is so fascinating, folks. My goodness, the Genesis 6 conspiracy, you got to get that book because the foundation is all laid out there. Look, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 8 minutes left, I believe. I don't want to take up any more of your time by my questions. Whatever your last your message would be in 8 minutes, go for it. I find this so, and by the way, when I see in Branson, Eric the Tech and I are going to bring some rope and a chair. We're going to tie you down and just make you talk with us for half a day.
That'll be awesome. That'll be awesome.
we'll allow you to eat, drink, and go to the bathroom, but otherwise you're tied down to us. All right. Just tell us what we need to know.
Yeah, let me tie a little bit more in here, and I'll tie in the angels with Revelation 9, Abaddon and Apollyon and Son of Perdition. And I'll try and do this very quickly with there's very little time here. So Antichrist is the one who comes up out of the abyss, who once was, now is not, but will be again. And he's also called the son of perdition. Perdition goes back to the Greek series of words that's rooted in the same word as Apollyon. And Apollyon means destroyer, as Abaddon means destroyer. And so when you look at Antichrist in the book of Daniel, he is going to honor a god of forces. That's the Hebrew word maoz. And that goes back to a series of words that includes azad, 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 and ezad, which is goat, which goes back to scapegoat, which is Hebrew for Azazel. So put E-L on the root words for maoz, and you get Azazel as the god of forces, who is the god of war in the antediluvian epoch. And Abaddon is the one is the word that goes back to Abad as the destroyer, Jeremiah 51, when Babylon is destroyed, and Antichrist is the one who destroys Babylon in Revelation 17. So the son of perdition is connected to Azazel, Abad, and Apollyon, and thus the angelic rebellion, because it's Abad and Apollyon who comes up out of the abyss. So the only way you can rationalize that is that there's going to be a fake resurrection, and we know Antichrist has a fatal head wound, and I believe Azazel, Abad, and Apollyon will enter into Antichrist and honor that god of forces and fake the resurrection in the end time. And when you connect all of these things together, back to the bloodlines that we were just talking about, all of a sudden things start to sort of crystallize.
Wow. And that, you're talking about tying it up, that just tied it up. And we have time left. So, okay. So what should we be looking for as Christians, as Bible-believing Christians right now? What should we be looking for to protect ourselves from this counterfeit stuff out there?
Learn what's in the Bible. Learn how it connects back to prehistory, because, you know, as we know, even the elect are going to be deceived. We're not even going to trust our leaders, and the counterfeits are going to be so real that if you don't understand prophecy and what prophecy is really saying, you're going to fall for the false prophets, for the false religion, and for the false Christ. And it's going to be too late when Jesus comes back.
I got to ask you, how do you know all this? How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, I started my research in about 1980, and I started writing the book in about 1996 or 1997. And even though it's over 800 pages and I took out about 350 pages just to get it published, you know, there's that many years that are in it, in the writing. And all I was trying to do was, in my first book, is just, I'm a prophecy buff, so I wanted to link Genesis 6 with the end time and see whether I could tell a story and see whether or not I could actually get published. But, you know, when I mixed in, I decided to mix in some of the parallel accounts around the world so that Christians could read what our enemies believe.
Right.
Then it just took me down all these different rabbit holes for, you know, like, you know, a dozen years.
Well, you know, I like to ask that question, not as a softball question, but I like to ask it because to me, that tells me what kind of, investigative work product this book is. And folks, if you read, I mean, look, read it, the Genesis 6 conspiracy. You will understand how we are being laughed at, how we're, information is being manipulated, and how we potentially could be deceived even as believers. So we can't afford that. So stay close to the Word, stay close to the Bible, and of course, increase your knowledge. The Genesis 6 conspiracy. I want to thank you. I mean, what a pleasure to have you on. You'll come back, right?
I will come back anytime you invite me.
All right, because we can talk for another 2, 3, 4 hours on this. Again, I want to thank you. And folks, Gary Wayne is going to be in Branson, True Legends Conference, speaking there. You're going to want to get close up front and listen to him. Your topic is going to be this very topic, right?
I will be talking specifically about prehistory in terms of the primeval period between Genesis 1-1 to 2, and then I will be linking that into end time prophecy and why it's important to be able to match those things up.
Amen. Okay, that's good. Now, with a couple of minutes, a minute or two I got left here. Any people on the world stage you're watching and kind of saying, watch this guy or watch this person? Is there a short answer to that, and is that a fair question?
Oh yeah, like Xi and Putin are very, very important in terms of non-European ones. The European ones to watch aren't that clear to me yet. I mean, I know people are looking at William. They're looking at, you know, a few other, royals. I don't think that's as clear to me. What I do know, though, is that the European bloodlines, they keep three Antichrist figures ready to go all the time. So, they're not going to be caught off guard when the time comes. So that's according to their writings, I take them at face value.
And they know they're in that position, and they're like in the, what's that, Eric Tech, what's that phrase for, they're in the dugout, you know, ready to go on the field?
Oh yeah.
Whatever.
They are primed and they're ready.
So they know.
On deck.
They know. On deck.
They're on deck. Yes, they're all hands on deck. And that's what's been so frustrating with them in the last 4 or 5 years, because they thought they were there.
Now, folks, do you get it? Oh, Gary Wade, so, you did a great job, man. Do you get it now, folks? They got about 45 seconds and got to cut your list.
Sure. So that's why it's important to understand what the response is when they get setbacks. Then they increase the heat. They will refocus, but in a more frenetic way. It's called birth pangs.
Huh. Oh, my friend Gary Wayne, thank you so very much for a wonderful presentation. I can't wait for you to come back. I thank you for writing the book, and thanks for being a presenter at Branson True Legends. I really appreciate that. I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Folks, you've got to get this. The Genesis 6 Conspiracy. I mean, let me tell you, what a great read. It'll forever change your worldview. Thanks for joining me tonight. May God bless you. Going to be back full swing tomorrow with video. Have a good night.